Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm your host, Kate Swanell. Clinical handover happens thousands of times a day in Australian hospitals. And sometimes identifying a patient's cultural heritage can be a medically relevant thing to do. A group of West Australian researchers set out to find out if cultural heritage was being identified for some groups more than others, and if so, why? Is it bias or is it medical necessity? Their research is published at mja.com.au and is open access. Co-authors Dr. David Morgan, a visiting medical specialist in the South Metropolitan Health Service in Perth, and Tanya Harris, an Aboriginal advocate and liaison officer with the Health Consumers Council of WA, are my guests today. Thank you both for your time. So we're talking about the identification of a patient's cultural heritage at both clinical handover and in electronic medical records within a hospital ward. Why did this research need doing?
I guess from my point as the lead researcher, I've been a doctor now for over 20 years, and I've worked in most Australian states and territories, and I've just made a consistent sort of personal observation, having worked in emergency departments, intensive cares, acute medical units, that handover, which is a ubiquitous sort of part of what we do, that one group of patients have seemed to be identified more often than others, yeah. And an inconsistent manner, and also without any obvious reason to me as to why that was happening. I wasn't seeing what the benefit of it was, how it was benefiting the patient. I've noticed that for a number of years, but it was galvanised a couple of years ago when a famous Aboriginal artist ended up in the news, mm-hmm. After being essentially racially profiled, yeah. And parked in the corner of an emergency department and being labelled as an alcoholic when they weren't. And that really galvanised me because the minister for that area came out strongly defending the hospital, and I was sitting at home and thought, actually, no, I could see this happening. Galvanised me to start. And the first thing I wanted to do really was to come down to Health Consumer Council and talk to somebody like Tanya and make sure that what I'm thinking of was actually going to be something that could be of use for the health and well-being and certainly not detrimental. And so that's where I ended up meeting Tanya.
Tanya, what were your thoughts on this issue before you met David, and how have they changed?
So at the Health Consumers Council, and certainly in my kind of role, it's about helping Aboriginal people access better care, putting complaints, sort of empowering them, I guess, to get better care and services from health and health. And there are sort of, you know, some issues that have been around for, I think, a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, I think, is that consumers definitely feel that they get treated differently because they're Aboriginal. And so when David, you know, came to us, it was sort of really, found it really interesting that it was happening and that he'd noticed anyway that it was sort of happening and quite a lot that Aboriginal people were being identified quite often. Our Aboriginal reference group, and they were really interested, and they're made up of, you know, health service people and consumers, and they were really very sort of keen on us helping and supporting David to do it, and so we did, and it was certainly been kind of an interesting project. And when we sort of took some of the, you know, preliminary results, the meeting went about three times longer than and everyone has since. So I think it's clearly something that's going to be really interesting to Aboriginal community and Aboriginal health workers, and even to sort of start thinking about what does it mean getting better care.
When is ethnicity or heritage relevant medically, David?
You know, that's part of the question that we were trying to broach. I guess the first thing was that we were trying to see how often it actually happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the real crux of what we were trying to achieve in this study, is to document, because to the best of my knowledge, certainly in Australia, and I couldn't find any research that was comparable from any other country that actually documents how often this happens. And given that handover is a daily occurrence, happens thousands of times around Australia and around the world, I was surprised that I couldn't find anything about it. We did broach it a little bit towards the end by sending out a survey and asking the doctors who had been in the acute care unit where the study was performed some of their thoughts. And I guess that was that was interesting. Most of the respondents felt that there was a role for mentioning somebody's cultural heritage, whether mm-hmm. that be the nationality, ethnicity, or religion. But then it sort of like broke down and as to, I guess, individual sort of groups as to where that may or how that may be helpful. The two groups that were identified predominantly by the responders in the survey were religious side of things, were Jehovah's Witnesses, and we got a fairly consistent reason as to why that would happen, i.e. that it was related around blood transfusions. Came to ethnicity and nationality, then the majority of people recognised that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders were being recognised. But as Tanya and I were just talking about, they seemed to be, the reasons were far more varied and less consistent than for obviously for something like the Jehovah's Witness group. And the respondents was everything from the possibility of bias through to accessing additional services through to medical diseases that might be more prevalent.
So give us a quick overview of your research design and why you chose that way of doing it.
So it's a four-phase study, of which the primary phase was observing a large group of, well, it's really a multidisciplinary handover that had occurred mm-hmm. twice a day in a sizable hospital. And the main concept was to observe handover for written, which was on a electronic journey board that was placed up for every patient, yep. and a verbal citation of somebody's cultural heritage.
Yep.
And so that was done essentially by me, and that was done in a covert manner. In other words, the group didn't know they were being observed, and that led to obviously a number of different ethical issues that we had to broach before we could undertake the study.
Yep.
And then we followed those patients through up onto the ward and went through the electronic medical record after they were discharged to look for ward-based teams identification or citation. So that was only written. Right. So that was two main phases following the patients through. But also we did another I was a bit worried about what we call a Hawthorne effect. In other words, if people yep. are being observed, that they will act differently. So we looked at 200 patients through their medical records before the study was undertaken to make sure that citation rates weren't any different. And then the final phase was that what we call phase four, which was the survey, which I'd mentioned about before. Mm-hmm. So there were four phases altogether that was done. And that was done under extensive consultation with Tanya and also Martin Whiteley and Ron Gidjup. So what I guess what Tanya, I just want to expand a little bit on what Tanya said. When I mm-hmm. came to meet with Tanya, it wasn't a yes, let's get on with this straight away. It was let's step back a moment and let's get some other opinions and let's explore the topics further. And, yeah. and as we actually did it, that kind of helped develop because Tanya actually, Martin and Ron bought you know, a number of different concepts that I hadn't actually thought about and some other things that we should look at. As, mm-hmm. as Ted mentioned earlier, she arranged for us to meet with the Aboriginal reference group both before and after the study as well. So it was something that evolved really the design over probably about, I'd say about 6 months.
So what were your major conclusions?
The mentioning of somebody's cultural heritage explicitly in the setting of a handover, which is you know supposed to be succinct and short, was inconsistent with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients being recognised substantially or significantly more often than any other group. And then when we adjusted for this by looking at other factors like socioeconomic degree of comorbidities, degree of acute health, that when we took all those into account, that there still was a strong signal that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients were being recognised substantially more often than any other group. One thing of particular interest, which Tanya and I again were just talking about, was that we looked at patients born overseas, because I would have thought that would be a group that would probably be more identified.
Yes.
And we didn't find, in fact, we found there was no statistical significance in the identification of patients born overseas. So I found that also particularly an interesting comparison.
I'm chatting today with David Morgan and Tanya Harris about cultural heritage identification of hospital patients. Their research is available at mja.com.au, where it is open access, as is all our Indigenous and research content. You can also find all our podcasts there, or you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes. Back to our chat. Given that there are some medical reasons why Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients would be identified, as you said, some chronic diseases are more prevalent in that population than in others. Is the damage done by not explaining the reason for the identification, or is the damage done when the identification is done for reasons other than medical relevance?
I think that's a great question, Kate. I really do. And I don't think I really know the answer. Mm. I mean, one of the things we did was we looked at how often a reason was supplied at any time, and of the total cohort, only 18% of patients had the reason why they were identified explained at any point in time, and that fell away down to 10% when the patient was either Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Tanya, what do you feel about that sort of identification and how it may help or hinder?
I think it was, because that was one of the things, I guess, that we talked about a lot, and as a reference group after as well, you know, it would be great to really get some sort of answers behind that, I guess. But, you know, our concerns, I guess, around the identification as well, how people were being identified, so how the identification of Aboriginal people was happening anyway, and was it coming from, were Aboriginal people identifying themselves? Was it just coming from patient information at the hospital, or was it just coming from people, doctors, thinking, you know, that they recognise them as being Aboriginal? And that was something, you know, we talked about a lot. You know, if they're going to be identifying people, then it needs to not just be, oh, I think that person's Aboriginal, so I'm going to start calling them Aboriginal. That, you know, we have such a massive diversity in Aboriginal people now that we don't all look the same.
No.
We have surnames that might be, you know, recognised as Aboriginal. You know, it's just a really diverse group, so it needs to come from somewhere. And if it's not, then you're either... And the reason for identifying is to provide better care.
Yeah.
And you're not identifying people in a better way, if you know what I mean, like in an actual accurate, correct way, then how are you providing better care? You know, and that was the concern, I think, that we all talked about. You know, what does it mean? And
so I would imagine there's a fine line between it gaining the patient better care or more relevant care and causing that patient to be treated more negatively.
Recognised as Aboriginal and you're missing out on services that, you know, might be available for you in that hospital just because no one's identified you as that and you haven't had the opportunity to kind of, you know, you've never been asked, because often you don't even get asked when you go into hospital once you've had it, you know, the first time. They don't...
Should no patients be identified culturally, or should every patient be identified that way?
Well, I think that's a interesting question. I think the community... Maybe we should be talking about a bit more as a community. What are the actual benefits? Oh, none should, because I think there are benefits to it. But I think we need to be really clear on why and what do we want from that, you know, as a community. What do we want that to mean to health services, and what does it mean to health services now?
I think they're really great points. And I guess when we conceived the study and we looked into this thing, and in fact, Tanya opened my eyes up, and Ron opened my eyes up to the issue of the diversity as well, which may well explain why there is inconsistency with identification. But as we delved into this, I guess we realised that it opens up many more questions, and what we really wanted to do was stay on, I guess, that first step is this happening?
Yeah.
If it's happening, how often is it happening? And then just take some early steps by doing the survey afterwards. I guess we always hope that this might open up a conversation amongst not just the medical profession, but also, you know, the consumer as well.
Mm-hmm.
What expectations of the consumer, which are, you know, Tanya's highlighted very nicely there.
And I know some government databases really want to know if the patient is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. Do you think that's affecting whether patients are being asked that question more often than not?
Probably. I think it, you know, it's a pretty common question now when you go and, you know, have to give your name, address, do you identify as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander? It's pretty standard. And, you know, certainly that gets questioned, I think, with people. And what do you want to know that for? You know,
yep.
And I think people need to be in organisations and governments a bit clearer about why they actually want to know that and what has that benefit to people. And I know from talking to some consumers that they would rather not identify because they don't think it gets them better service, that they think people do make assumptions and that they get treated really poorly. And so many stories about people, Aboriginal people, that have been treated very poorly for no other reason other than they are Aboriginal. So I think it's a legitimate concern.
And surely that's where the importance of explaining why you're asking is vital, yeah.
And people, I guess, need to know, you know, they need to have some direction from that, from government and community on why they're asking and what they're going to be doing with that information and is it going to benefit us?
I guess it's one of the worries. I agree with Tanya. I mean, I certainly know that in the hospital system, there's a number of different forms that medical and nursing staff have to fill in where there's a, you know, an explicit question, is the patient Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander? Like Tanya says, does that lead to better services or does it reinforce negative stereotypes?
Yeah.
I have the answer for that. But once again, it was something that, you know, we certainly talked about extensively while putting together this project and something we hope that maybe somebody else might pick up on with future research as well.
Well, that was my next question. What would you like to see happen next?
From a medical point of view, I'll talk about a medical and,
sure.
and I get Tanya to talk from the consumer point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I guess from the medical point of view, I would like to see a conversation open up as to why we do this and is it really relevant? I mean, handover, the whole idea of handover, you know, this handover can consume a lot of time in you know, if you're in a large department like an emergency department.
Yep.
And really the idea of handover, because there's been a lot of work and a lot of publications by the Australian Medical Association, the British Medical Association,
mm-hmm.
really that needs to be succinct, relevant and pertinent to the patient's care. If it's not, then it shouldn't be included. So, you know, if you're mentioning somebody's ethnicity without a reason, I'm not quite sure of what its relevance is at that point in time. So I would hope gauge hospital administrators, perhaps even going back a step to universities and seeing where the role lies for the medical staff. But I also, you know, and working with Tanya, I think that we've got to look at this from both sides. So I would ask sort of Tanya's opinion about, you know, what the next step might be from the health consumer.
I would hope that it will start, like David said, conversations and conversations with community and conversations with community and health services and see what, is this what we want and how do we make sure that people aren't being missed? It's a great thing to be Aboriginal and we, you know, should be really proud of it and be, you know, declaring it all over the place and
yep.
would be, it's a worry, I guess, that, you know, there are some really wonderful Aboriginal services out there support hospitals and be a concern that people aren't getting access to that because they're not being, you know, recognised as being Aboriginal in that service. So to make sure, you know, from a health consumer point of view, that make sure that everyone is getting access to those services and that services have sort of cultural training, I guess, that recognises the diversity in our community. And I think that would be really good. And I guess to have another think about or someone to do some research on when they do identify, when doctors are identifying Aboriginal people, what do they mean by that? And that was something that we talked about a lot. Like, what is the saying, oh, that's an Aboriginal person in bed 20? What does that mean? What does that mean to them? Go and call the ALOs, make sure that they're there. Does it mean that we might need to accommodate quite a number of family members coming in? Or does it, they're just saying it like it has no meaning? Or, you know, what is the meaning behind it, I think would be great. Sort of know.
The medical schools now have a bit of cultural safety and awareness education going on. Is there enough? Is it good enough?
I would think not. even in the, you know, the responders to the survey said that they didn't think that they thought it was important, and that there wasn't half of them, they said didn't think that there was enough. Most of the training's online training here, and it's not enough, and it's not appropriate, and it needs to be taken, I think, a bit more
seriously.
Something that is,
yeah.
I think it needs to, I mean, Tanya and I, once again, with Ron and Martin, have talked about this extensively, and I agree with everything Tanya said. I mean, just to give you some idea, is that the, you know, cultural safety teaching at the institution where I work is, as Tanya said, it's an online module, and it literally, I would use the term, it's buried amongst about 20 other online teaching modules that the staff have to do within their own time. And not surprisingly, it takes quite a bit of time to get through these many modules, and so there's an emphasis just to try and work through it as quickly as possible. I do know down at my institution, though, that they are now starting to do where they're getting the Aboriginal liaison officers to come up and talk to the junior doctors in small groups, and that's not widespread yet. But from talking to Ron Gidjup, one of our co-authors who's integral in part of that, he was suggesting the early feedback was positive from that. Cultural awareness, cultural safety is important, but we probably could do that. We could be more robust. We would hope that this might interest other people to become involved and to explore some of these things. I think really all we've done now is touch the tip of the iceberg, and we looked into this. I think there was more opportunity. We sort of delved further and other opportunities for research to be done here. Okay, thank you so much for your time.
Not a worry, David. Thank you, Tanya, for joining in. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.